Welcome to the Musings series, audio book readings, reading from Photo Albums of the Heart Mind, published by All Book Books, written by monk Walter E. Harris III. Thanks for listening.
Okay, wrapping up the Photo Albums of the Heart Mind audio presentation. Audio book, can it be called a book if it's audio? I won't answer these and other questions. Some of the back notes, the footnotes. I do a lot of research, so sometimes I try not to overload that, but sometimes it just flows. Someone commented that in the Musings with the Golden Sparrow book that they liked the quotes because you know, there may be certain points where, as a writer, I'm trying to say something, and it may come across as plausible, but the information backs it up. As you know, see, this has a point, or see, this is an actuality, or a fact, or people experience this. So, however you want to label it. So, this Photo Albums of the Heart Mind has 98 quotes. I won't go through them all. Just to mention that. Some are from books, some are from website articles, some esoteric, some news, and Wikipedia, though often one must take with a grain of salt as far as esoteric or spiritual information, even native peoples, indigenous peoples, and some historical information. You can find some interesting stuff. That's where I found some things about the jinn and the Arabic quotes I found especially interesting. So that's about it on much to say about the quotes without the footnotes, except diving deep in, which I don't feel like doing. Then the book has the little pictures of the Tao Te Ching, Tao Te Jin, and the page numbers where the ancient pictographs are at, because it's meant as more of a deep study, because you know, you just read the page and you might get something from it, but that is, you know, virtually nothing compared to actually spending some time and studying the pictures, applying it to your life, and on. So each one has the page numbers it goes to as a, you know, a reference point. And then there's the thanks. Of course, I try to thank anybody who helped with the book. Anybody who made a suggestion or read something, or, you know, even somebody I don't know, like in this one, Eduardo Galeano's writings, you know, were a bit of an encouragement to be as concise as possible. The other night I was reading some Mumia Abu-Jamal, and he has, you know, he packs more into a page or a page and a half than any writer I've ever read. So that's typically what the thanks are about, and various people, friends and family. And sometimes I found this, I don't know what it means, but over the history of publishing stuff, people that were friends and they get thanked, and then they go off the list. So it's kind of a touch of poignant listing of people. But that's the way it goes in life and publishing, I suppose. And then the last page of the book has a little bio and author bio with my photo. I was visiting my mom one day and I saw on the little table a bunch of old family photos, and I saw this little picture of me as a two-year-old. So I took a cell phone photo of that, and that's what's in there. And it along with being, I guess, kind of humorous, it also helps me looking at, it's amazing to look at oneself as a tiny being, and sort of just kind of reconnect with that inner child energy. And also, obviously, it fit the part of the motivation for doing that was fitting the theme, Photo Albums of the Heart Mind. So before getting into the overview of the book, also mentioned at the end of the book is the next book is book 3 of the looks like to be 4, is to be titled The Bookless Book. And that phrase just came up while writing the second to last page of this book. And there's a Zen text called The Gateless Gate, so it's going to be a bit of a Zen tour de farce, and what it's being called, and kind of a look at what books can and cannot do, as well as an exploration of how the printing press and the evolution of books has affected our consciousness in the context of other ways of learning, for example, the direct transmission of energy that Zen teachers impart to their students and peers, and the oral traditions of poetry and original peoples. One of the most well-known stories that comes to mind is the Buddha giving a lecture and blah, 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 no offense to the Buddha, of course, and at the end of the lecture, twirling a flower in his hand, and there was a glance between him and, I don't know how to pronounce it, Kashyapya, and that he became his disciple or student because they connected. It wasn't exactly the words, although the words have a place, hence that sort of double play of the bookless book. But I'm fascinated by that whole, you know, that transmission in the Zen and other mystical teachings and lineages. There is literally that kind of transmission of energy that one does to another. And it can happen by, you know, living with someone, or it can happen in kind of a, you know, like a sort of deathbed, intense, dramatic kind of thing. It can happen with anyone. You know, you don't have to be, we all sort of carry things from friends, family, wherever. So it's not specifically related to, say, you know, Zen teachings. But I find that one of the highlights of the Zen, and which again, Zen reflecting that, a lot of the stories reflecting the busting of the intellectual and I think I know, therefore I am mode. So, and then that touches in with, you know, a recurring theme in this series of the nature energies and how much the original peoples are connected with that. And so this era of learning from our elder brothers and sisters about that is highly significant. So anyway, that's underway. Notes are in the files. And so it goes. And poetry too. You know, that poetry originally as a oral tradition. So there's a lot to be said for the oral tradition. We're kind of now in this age of the visual. See right there, I got to make a note to add to that. We're sort of in the visual age. But there's still books. There's still information that people read. There's misinformation. So many levels, many topics to address. So this book, let's see, Photo Albums of the Heart Mind, as mentioned in the book, the idea was rolling around about at a certain point in my early 50s, that places I was going to, either the place was redecorated or was no longer there, and certain people I had experiences with, you know, the place had changed, so the exact place memory had changed, or the people had moved on or moved or something. Things were the notice of things changing, so that became this kind of mantra of photo out. Where am I going to keep track? Where am I going to, carry these memories with me? How am I going to do that if I go to the place and the memory is a little different or changed or not there? So it became photo albums of the mind. Okay, I'm going to carry this sort of photo album in my mind. And I suppose that's more natural to happen with age. But then again, reading in the news that with the refugee crisis, lots of people moving around and just sort of the consciousness thing or lack of going on, that people feel like they're, you know, with climate change, people feel like they're not, they're sort of don't know where they are so much anymore. And so that showed me that the title and the motif was not just an age thing, but for anybody, for any time, to that we all at some level carry these images and feelings and our lives in a way inside us, and that can be as significant, if not more so, because wherever you go, there you are. So there's you're carrying that with you. And then the phrase, the heart-mind phrase from the Chinese, and also hearing it from heart-thinking from Teokusin, Ghost Horse, the host of the First Voices Radio and a Lakota flute player and more. He uses that phrase a lot. So the heart think, it was like, wait a minute, not just photo albums in the mind, but the heart mind. So one of the gists of the book was wanting to put forth the, not only to help people connect with and kind of nurture that inner place, to carry that energy with, you know, with oneself, but also to encourage the heart and mind connection and the feeling, because the culture, the news, the education, it can tend to be very mental and intellectual, and we tend to sort of overlook the feelings and the connection with feelings, and not just feelings, it's sort of too generically specific, but the heart, you know, whatever the heart means, that's up to you. And, you know, put forth some of that in the book, and that whole zone of empathy and the kind of the time shift, that time space shift that happens when one is in with the heart space rather than the mental space, which can be very as wonderful as it can be very time and kind of logistical oriented. So there's a place for that yet. And then let's see, the other, as the first section is undercurrent. So I wanted to convey that sense of, you know, looking beneath the surface of things. And that's a theme that goes throughout the book, as Glenn Aparicio Perry kindly noticed and mentioned in his review of the book, that it's there's a like a constant prodding to look beneath the surface. I guess another whole side topic is how much that is the result of a superficial world. There's so much superficial, but that's a whole other topic. But anyway, the idea is to look at the signs and connect with feelings and whatever else that is under the surface. And then from there, it just sometimes it's hard to even remember exactly some things. As an author, in the process of it, I can remember exactly what the decision was, and other times it just kind of flows as sort of a instinctual or intuitive or muse inspired decision. So it's hard to remember why did I do that, but just it got into the progression. So that's the progression of the book, was to try to show the different levels of the heart mind. So it seemed to fit that there would be having to address the, you know, trauma and pain or whatever you call it, the cry of the heart mind, and then that there would be a turning point. So that's the next chapter, turning points of the heart mind, and then have to have joy of the heart mind. And then a lot of societal things that I wanted to address and put forward, because the book is sort of in this framework of trying to show people there are different ways to see the world, and to present some of the ways we see the world and how we came to see the world, thus the history of the Hollywood and the motion pictures and the whole camera motif, and how that has affected our vision and our thinking and our consciousness and what we do. You know, how much sway Hollywood movies have and TV ads have and magazine photos, and they're just, it's very powerful stuff, and it can take, you know, decades to get to deprogram from some of that stuff and to replace or to cultivate a new kind of original vision. I mean, I think of the, even though it's not an accurate translation, but the Lakota Vision Quest. I mean, there's a culture where, at a young age, people are specifically guided to have a vision, to see their future. Whereas in the U.S. culture, I think it's off to college, and the vision is of a job or what's in the books, and it's not so much as a bigger picture. So that's a big part of the addressing the society, to see where the images are coming from and how to dance around them or through them. And then the chapter on the Tao of photography was getting into more of the esoteric and the meditative seeing some of the similarities between the meditative states and the process of the actual camera and the photos, and how we can be both guided and misguided by images. And then the sense that there is a deep place, a sort of inner sanctum, a sacred spaces we may not even talk about to anyone, that each person has. And then as one goes on a spiritual path or journey, I think though that becomes heightened, that sense of making sacred space, and whether it's taking your shoes off before you go inside, or a altar space in one's house or apartment, or a meditation room, or whatever it is, I think that and those can be outer physical as well as inner. So that became the motivation for the chapter, Journey to the Center of the Heart Mind, and examples and images of people that do that and how to do that. And again, just as I state in the beginning of the book, these are photo albums that are things that I particularly carry with me, but presumably a lot of it relatable to anyone, and also that it encourage. Hopefully, one of the gists of the book is, sure, I want the reader to get what I put into the book, but if anything, that they come away feeling that it stirred their own wanting to kind of build up their own energy photo album of the heart mind and see their life and times in that way. That would be fine if you forget the book and do it yourself, kind of thing. But there is a lot of information and stuff in the book that I truly think is not forgettable, and is, there's a lot of information. Some people have commented having to read it more than once. Some people have blazed through it and read it once. But the pictures of the Tao Te Ching, and those I think are, just that alone is worth a study. And then there's other information, pictures, different links, and whether you're into Zen or Taoist or Native or philosophy, well-being, Kabbalah, whatever. And then towards the end of the book, I wanted to put, I tried to balance a sort of heavy light, not do too much at once. So I wanted to have a kind of reprieve. And so the idea to how much the epigraph quotes, how much I find them significant. So I figured, hey, let's explain those, and also the how much songs are a part of my life, and song quotes, and how much I find them a guide and like reminders and mantras. And then the songs and other musings, the whole process of creativity, since this is a book two of the musing series. So that's an ongoing thing. And that all kind of built up to the longest chapter, the spider. And here's where I guess the gist of the book that I, as I got to this sort of thematic kind of, hopefully not too sort of too much or too conceptual or whatever you call it, but sort of the vision and the theme and the idea, the sort of framework I wanted to present, which I think it is presented, how gettable it is up to the reader. But the motif of the Indra's net and the spider web, and how that connects with not only the internet, which we call the World Wide Web, and when you drive, at least in America, across, you see, or just go to your local store, you see poles and wires. So there's this huge, literal, physical sense of a network and spider-like, spider sense to our daily lives. And then there's hearkening back to the beginning of the undercurrents and the subtleties. That was one of the gists I want to put forward in the book, is the paying attention with all the things going on in the world, which can seem overwhelming and chaotic and, too much information overload. Who do you trust? How do you know what to do with your life? And sometimes it's the most simple, subtle things. So that's some of the gist of the undercurrents, the hair on the back of your neck, a gut feeling, suddenly you get turned on. You have an idea or an intuition or a dream, or I think those are some of the under the radar, call it the under the radar, whether it's subconscious, superconsciousness, all these labels, but they are subtle levels, dimensions, that ways in which we move and communicate and evolve, and that's the very subtle spider webs connecting us. And then that is kind of presented as juxtaposed with the more geopolitical, societal, full spectrum dominance of the military-industrial complex of the U.S. empire and the global corporate empire, this corporate and military stuff that in the mining to make that happen, that essentially, rules the day-to-day, business world and whatever. This is basic society is ruled by that stuff. And so we have these, perhaps oversimplifying, and there may be, there's overlap, but that there's these sort of ways that you can travel the web. You can try to advance yourself and catch a lot of bugs, so to speak, that metaphor, or you can kind of work to build the consciousness of the web and network with people and get along, whether it's literally meeting people or on Facebook or emails or talking to people, however. So again, the juxtaposition of the gadgetry, which has a, I've heard it referred to as anti-social media, and it, on one level I agree, but there's also good things that can happen. So there's this kind of juxtaposition of our times that I see, of these layers of positive ways to use the technology, but also to be aware of the negative side of it, whether it's the process in which it gets mined for the products and how that affects Mother Earth, and sometimes children, underage children risking their lives to earn money to make these products, and then, but also how it connects us. So there's these ongoing layers of these webs, and so that's the gist of what is put forward in the last chapter, the spider, talking about pathways and web browsing, and referring to Standing Rock as one of the big lessons of our time, and examples of people working together, working with prayer and peacefully, and how this is the like original natural way to network, and I suppose the native all our relations would be a kind of another way to put forth or say or live the kind of spider's web sense. But that's the gist of the sort of overview vision I wanted to present in the last chapter. Was okay, here's this web, there's these big webs and we're all interconnected, and there's these mirrorings and reflections and all this stuff going on. Now how do you travel this? How do you get through your day? How do you connect or not connect with people? And so that can be fed by, okay, then you look back into the book and say, oh, okay, look at how society does it, or I can see how different cultures do it, or I see how, my meditations or my intuitions can do that, or these various traditions with the Buddhist, Zen, and Tao, and or whether I do photography or some other art form, how can I use that physical art form to convey what the spirit is guiding me to do. So there are many layers to it, and again, part of the reason I writing a book is that people will hopefully get something and get that from the book, but figured it would be interesting, at least it kind of helps me too to sum up what I tried to do in the book in a way to accentuate various parts and see how they all connect, because that's also part of the book, is to sort of different refrains. I like to put in refrains, so the sun and the moon is mentioned over and over, little subtleties that a reader may or may not pick up on, those threads. So the whole book, with a guidance of a literal spider as a kind of totem, was helping to weave the whole book and weave it together. And one quote I put in towards the end which is, to me, is kind of a metaphor of both the, or an example of, you know, the literalness and the mystery and who we each are, that I could work all this time on this book and you do what you do and this person does what they do, and then nature does what it does, and from the bird calendar, it takes as many as 12 days for an oriole to weave its nest. One Baltimore oriole was observed spending 40 hours building a nest with about 10,000 stitches and the tying of thousands of knots, all with its beak. I could have explained that more, but the point was to say, which is more important? Writing the book, or the bird doing that, or the ants moving around doing their thing, or the clouds changing shape? Is any of it any more important? We all are building our little nests or webs or whatever, and they are very sometimes solitary and yet working with all the elements, and yet they are interconnected and interdependent with all everything. So that feels like a good place to stop. So thank you again for listening, and keep on singing. Be well.